We'll begin this morning with a few words of wisdom from Koheleth, who is the author of the book of Ecclesiastes. Next, I saw under the sun something else that was pointless. There are people who are utterly alone, with no companions, not even a child or a sibling. Yet they work hard without end, never satisfied with their wealth. So for whom am I working so hard and depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is pointless and a terrible obsession. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their hard work. If either should fail, one can pick up the other. But how miserable are those who fall and don't have a companion to help lift them up. Also, if two lie down together, they can stay warm, but how can anyone stay warm alone? Also, one can be overpowered, but two together can put up a resistance. A three-ply cord does not easily snap. Though my math may be a wee bit off, I would guesstimate that in the last 20 plus years, I've had the opportunity, and for the most part, the pleasure, of preparing and delivering about 200 sermons. Over that same 20 year period, I've also enjoyed attending several synagogue services, a Sri Lankan Buddhist ceremony, a Hindu wedding. I've visited several mosques overseas and preached at a wide variety of churches, mainly UCC, but with a sprinkling of Methodist, Anglican, Presbyterian, and of course, a dab of Unitarianism. If nothing else, I consider myself ecumenical to the core. Needless to say, however, as far as preparing sermons goes, there are definite differences in approach. For the most part, mainline churches rely on what's referred to as the common lectionary, a three-year cycle of readings organized around three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But each week there are also three other readings included, usually one psalm, one reading from the Old Testament, and a selection from either the book of Acts or from a New Testament letter. And just in case you're interested, 2017 is Matthew's year. Now, as you well know, this is not the case here. And I have to tell you, I do enjoy the different focus. The challenge for me, however, is what will be my text? Fortunately, I have discovered that NPR is an excellent source of possibilities. Even though people like Phil have told me about certain books like Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, and I love that book, I suspect others here rely on NPR as well. Last week, Tracy Howe Koch, for instance, mentioned that NPR introduced her to the book which was the basis of her sermon on moving past original sin. And by the way, just in case you're interested, the word sin actually does not appear in the book of Genesis at all. And it certainly doesn't appear, therefore, in the story of Adam and Eve. Remember, story of Adam and Eve. Although the concept of original sin was alluded to sometime in the second century by Irenaeus, but the whole concept of original sin was not popularized until the fourth century when the church had become the religion of the Roman Empire. We can thank St. Augustine. Needless to say, many other shifts in interpretation occurred then and later on as well. Now, back to today. If you remember, last November, I shared with you the short but powerful book, The Tribe, by Sebastian Junger, and I know you've been studying that. And as I remember, the main text was only a little over 130 pages. Oh, there were notes, but once again, not many. Today, I am relying on four books. not to worry. Four books by sociologist Robert D. Putnam, a Harvard professor, most noted for a book he wrote in 2000 entitled Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. In contrast to The Tribe, these books together consist of over 1,900 pages. Although, to be fair, only 1,500 of those pages consist of actual text. The rest consist of acknowledgments, data analysis, notes, lots and lots of notes, and indices. But you can see the job of condensation to provide a 20-minute give or take sermon was a challenge, but it certainly was an interesting one. First, the time context, always important. Although Putnam had written several books before Bowling Alone, published in, this one was published in 2000, and it's his seminal one. So much so that just 6 weeks ago, it was referred to in an article in The Economist. It said that his book could provide current and future historians with important early warning signs of what occurred in our 2016 election. I thought that was very interesting. Now, I could have just relied on Putnam's 17-year-old book, but I thought since a lot has transpired since the year 2000, 9/11, our invasion of Afghanistan and Iran, the Arab Spring, and a number of important elections and economic situations, just to name a few, I thought a look at some of Putnam's later work would provide an important lens to see how his findings have played out over the years. And that's why I added Better Together, Restoring the American Community, co-written with Lewis Feldstein and published in 2003, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, written by Putnam and David E. Campbell, and that was published in 2010. And then most recently, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, which was written just by Putnam and published in 2015. However, I largely will be relying on Bowling Alone, which has as its central subject matter, as Putnam states early on, an in-depth analysis of what has happened to civic and social life over the years. He refers to the fact that in recent years, social scientists have framed concerns about the changing character of American society in terms of the concept of social capital, like the notions of physical capital and human capital, tools and training that enhance individual productivity. The core idea of social capital theory is that social networks have value. Now, I have to be honest, this language I think is a bit heady. As a result, I think I will frequently refer to this concept of as interpersonal tools that build community. Actually, Putnam also uses the term community, but he points out that we should not understand the word community as referring to something warm and cuddly. Communities can be, in fact, as we well know, based on ideas and behavior that's both malevolent and antisocial. So it's always important to ask how positive consequences of community building, that is mutual support, cooperation, trust, and institutional effectiveness can be maximized, and negative manifestations such as sectarianism, ethnocentrism, and corruption can be minimized. The aim should be towards inclusiveness, that is bridging with others, not just bonding to others in an exclusive way. Bonding, Putnam says, is a lot like super glue, whereas bridging is more like sociological WD-40. I like that. In truth, however, bonding and bridging are not an either-or sort of category, but more or less dimensions along which we can compare different forms of community building and maintenance. Now, that said, we can turn to the heart of Putnam's analysis of what has happened to American society over the years, especially since the 1950s. As it turns out, and I'm sure lots of you are aware of this, the post-World War II generation was perhaps the most civic-minded in all of our history. In the words of a Life magazine article in early 1964, Americans were flocking to all sorts of organizations, both civic and social. From bowling leagues, I have a feeling that's part of the title here, to garden clubs, and folks were satisfying their gregarious urges in countless neighborhood committees to improve things like local roads and garbage pickup. Church membership was also at an all-time high, as was participation in everything from bridge groups to the Elks clubs to the PTA. Early on, however, Putnam does raise one important caveat, which is important in thinking of all of this, and that is in the 50s and the 60s, this could not be considered a truly golden age for those Americans who were marginalized because of race, gender, social class, or sexual orientation. Segregation by race legally and by gender socially were the norm. America, at least as portrayed in Life magazine, for instance, was white, straight, Christian, comfortable, and at least in the public square, male. But then in the 60s and the 70s, things began to change. First slowly, and then increasingly rapidly. And this has rendered obsolete a significant stock of interpersonal community building. Would anyone like to name some of the factors that they think might be instrumental in this shift? Remember, we're talking up to the year 2000.
Consciousness raising.
What do you think is the most important thing? It starts with the letter T. Television. Suddenly, you didn't have to go out. You didn't have to clean house to have friends visit. You'd invite in TV friends. So more and more time was being spent inside. You might be with your immediate family, but you were sitting in front of the television, okay? That's the most important one. But actually, other things occurred too. We had the start of two career families in a much larger way than it had been before. We had suburban sprawl, which changed communities as well. And of course, a generational shift in values. While I would not say that Putnam ends Bowling Alone on a particularly positive note, he mentions, for instance, that at the end of the 20th century, unlike immediately following World War II, Americans felt vaguely and uncomfortably disconnected. And we wished we lived in a more civil, more trustworthy, and more collectively sharing community. However, he did retain a certain amount of optimism in suggesting that by working together, we could spark the civic imaginations of our fellow citizens to discover and work out new ways of connecting socially that fit our changed lives. He strongly promoted a stronger emphasis, that's a double word there, on civics education in grade school and high school, as well as encouraged well-designed community service projects for young people, perhaps with intergenerational mentoring as a component. Participation in extracurricular activities, he felt, was another way to increase civic and social involvement on the part of young people. We'll have to talk to our young people afterwards. But then there are the possibilities that could be developed in the workplace and in the new urbanism that was just taking place across in cities across the nation. And then, of course, there was the huge potential of faith-based communities. Nowhere, however, was there more need to restore connectedness, trust, and civic engagement than in public forums of our democracy. Financial capital, he said, desperately needs to be replaced by social capital. And finally, Putnam points out that no sector of the American society will have more influence on the state of social connectedness than the electronic mass media, especially the internet. But for this to work, he says, it needs to be part of the solution instead of a big part of the problem. And all of us need to spend less time sitting passively in front of glowing screens and more time in active face-to-face interaction with our fellow citizens. To build bridging social capital, community connectedness requires that we transcend our social, political, and professional identities to connect with people not just like us, but unlike ourselves. Now, though I mentioned earlier presentation of the major findings and focus of bowling alone was my primary goal today, Putnam's later books each offer some interesting thoughts. Better Together presents an analysis of 12, in quotes, success stories of people who have built and participated in networks of positive relationship. One important, though not surprising, finding was that building and maintaining social networks takes time and patience, somewhat like the hymn that we sang this morning. It's an incremental and cumulative process. It tends to be a local phenomenon. Smaller is better than larger, and usually it's developed in the pursuit of a particular goal or set of goals. It's also about building relationships through conversations which can actually change us. Abstract ideas do not connect people, stories do. And doing with is far superior than doing for. The iron rule, he says, is allowing people to do for themselves what they're able to do for themselves. The goal is always to avoid a certain kind of colonial welfareism. Found that interesting. The focus of our kids is a discussion about the increasingly stark divisions between the haves and have-nots in all of American society. Putnam begins by revisiting his hometown of Port Clinton, Ohio, which in the 50s was one of those booming industrial towns and is now a prime example of the Rust Belt phenomenon. He then goes on to address rapid changes which have occurred not only there, but across the United States. And finally, American Grace, which, as its subtitle indicates, is a study of how religion divides and unites us. Of all four books, perhaps this is the most upbeat of all of them, because though it discusses the growth of conservative religious groups in the wake of the sexually libertine 1960s and those groups' influence on partisan politics, which we're all very aware of, it also affirms that, as in truth, only about 10% of the population can be classified as fundamentalists, those claiming there's only one true religion. In fact, there's an increasing number of mixed marriages now, okay, mixed faith marriages, which has tended to make most of us more accepting of folks of different faiths. And it is this growing web of interlocking personal relationships among many people of many different faiths, which Putnam and Campbell celebrate as the heart of America's grace. Now, in closing, I am going to turn once again to what I began with, assuming I can find it. Next, I saw under the sun something else that was pointless. There are people who are utterly alone, with no companions, not even a child or a sibling. Yet they work hard without end, never satisfied with their wealth. So for whom am I working so hard and denying myself enjoyment? This too is a pointless and terrible obsession. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their hard work. If either should fall, one can pick the other up. But how miserable are those who fall and don't have a companion to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they can stay warm. But how can anyone stay warm alone? Also, one can be overpowered, but two together can put up resistance. A three-ply cord doesn't easily snap. In the area of building and maintaining positive human relationships, there really is nothing new under the sun.